in a lowered voice. "Don't mention this marriage thing to Georgina." He had imagined Georgina, from the way Emenika spoke of her, as a fragile innocent, a successful lawyer who nonetheless did not truly know the evils of the world. But when she arrived, square-faced with a big square body, brown hair crisply cut, giving her an air of efficiency, he could see right away that she was frank, knowing, even world-weary. He imagined her clients instantly trusting her ability. This was a woman who would check up on the finances of charities she gave to. This was a woman who would certainly survive a visit to Nigeria. Why had Emenike portrayed her as a hapless English rose? She pressed her lips to Emenike's, then turned to Sheik Obinze's hand. "Do you fancy anything in particular?" she asked Obinze, unbuttoning her brown suede coat. "There's a nice Indian place nearby." "Oh, that's a bit tatty," Emenike said. He had changed. His voice had taken on an unfamiliar modulation, his delivery slower, the temperature of his entire being much lower. "We could go to that new place in Kensington. It's not that far." "I'm not sure Obinze will find it very interesting, darling," Georgina said. "Oh, I think he'll like it," Emenike said. Self-satisfaction. That was the difference in him. He was married to a British woman, lived in a British home, worked at a British job, travelled on a British passport, said exercise to refer to a mental rather than a physical activity. He had longed for this life, and never quite believed he would have it. Now his backbone was stiff with self-satisfaction. He was sated. In the restaurant in Kensington, a candle glowed on the table, and the blonde waiter, who seemed too tall and handsome to be a waiter, served tiny bowls of what looked like green jelly. "Our new lemon and thyme aperitif, with the compliments of the chef," he said. "Fantastic," Emenike said, instantly sinking into one of the rituals of his new life. Eyebrows furrowed, concentration sharp, sipping sparkling water, and studying a restaurant menu. He and Georgina discussed the starters. The waiter was called to answer a question. It struck Obinze how seriously Emenike took this initiation into the voodoo of fine dining, because when the waiter brought him what looked like three elegant bits of green weed, for which he would pay £13, Emenike rubbed his palms together in delight. Obinze's burger was served in four pieces, arranged in a large martini glass. When Georgina's order arrived, a pile of red raw beef, an egg sunnily displayed on top of it, Obinze tried not to look at it as he ate, otherwise he might be tempted to vomit. Emenike did most of the talking, telling Georgina about their time together at school, barely letting Obinze say anything. In the stories he told, he and Obinze were the popular rogues who always got into glamorous trouble. Obinze watched Georgina, only now becoming aware of how much older than Emenike she was. At least 8 years. Her manly facial contours were softened by frequent brief smiles, but they were thoughtful smiles, the smiles of a natural skeptic, and he wondered how much she believed of Emenike's stories, how much love had suspended her reason. "We're having a dinner party tomorrow, Obinze," Georgina said. "You must come." "Yes, I forgot to mention it," Emenike said. "You really must come. We're having a few friends over, and I think you'll enjoy meeting them," Georgina said. "I would love to," Obinze said. Their terraced home in Islington, with its short flight of well-preserved steps that led to the green front door, smelled of roasting food when Obinze arrived. Emenike let him in.
"The Zed, your Ellie, we're just finishing up in the kitchen. Come and stay in my study until the others come."
Emenike led him upstairs and into the study, a clean, bright room made brighter by the white bookshelves and white curtains. The windows ate up large chunks of the walls, and Obinze imagined the room in the afternoon, flooded gloriously with light, and himself, sunk in the armchair by the door, lost in a book.
"I'll come and call you in a bit," Emenike said.
There were, on a window ledge, photos of Emenike squinting in front of the Sistine Chapel, making a peace sign at the Acropolis, standing at the Colosseum,
his shirt the same nutmeg colour as the wall of the ruin. Obinze imagined him, dutiful and determined, visiting the places he was supposed to visit, thinking as he did so, not of the things he was seeing, but of the photos he would take of them, and of the people who would see those photos. The people who would know that he had participated in these triumphs. On the bookshelf, Graham Greene caught his eye. He took the heart of the matter down and began to read the first chapter, suddenly nostalgic for his teenage years, when his mother would reread it every few months. Emenike came in.
"Is that war?"
"No." He showed him the book cover. "My mother loves this book. She was always trying to get me to love her English novels.
War is the best of them. Brideshead is the closest I've read to a perfect novel.
I think war is cartoonish. I just don't get those so-called comic English novels. It's as if they can't deal with the real and deep complexity of human life, and so they resort to doing this comic business. Green is the other extreme, too morose."
"No, man, you need to go and read War again. Green doesn't really do it for me, but the first part of The End of the Affair is terrific."
"This study is the dream," Obinze said. Emenike shrugged.
"Do you want any books? Take anything you want."
"Thanks, man," Obinze said, knowing that he would not take any. Emenike looked around as though seeing the study through new eyes.
"We found this desk in Edinburgh. Georgina already had some good pieces, but we found some new things together."
Obinze wondered if Emenike had so completely absorbed his own disguise that even when they were alone, he could talk about good furniture, as though the idea of good furniture was not alien in their Nigerian world, where new things were supposed to look new. Obinze might have said something to Emenike about it, but not now. Too much had already shifted in their relationship. Obinze followed him downstairs. The dining table was a riot of colour, bright mismatched ceramic plates, some of them chipped at the edges, red wine goblets, deep blue napkins. In a silver bowl at the centre of the table, delicate, milky flowers floated in water. Emenike made the introductions.
"This is Georgina's old friend, Mark, and this is his wife, Hannah, who, by the way, is completing her PhD on the female orgasm, or the Israeli female orgasm."
"Well, it isn't quite that singularly focused," Hannah said, to general laughter, warmly shaking Obinze's hand.
She had a tanned, broad-featured, suckering face, the face of a person who could not abide conflict. Mark, pale-skinned and rumpled, squeezed her shoulder but did not laugh along with the others. He said, "How do you do?" to Obinze, in an almost formal manner.
"This is our dear friend Philip, who is the best solicitor in London, after Georgina, of course," Emenike said.
"Are all the men in Nigeria as gorgeous as you and your friend?" Philip asked Emenike, swooning mockingly as he shook Obinze's hand.
"You'll have to come to Nigeria and see," Emenike said, and winked, in what seemed to be a continuous flirtatiousness with Philip.
Philip was slender and elegant, his red silk shirt open at the neck, his mannerisms, supple gestures of his wrists, fingers swirling in the air, reminded Obinze of the boy in secondary school. His name was Hadome, who was said to pay junior students to suck his dick. Once, Emenike and two other boys had lured Hadome into the toilet and beaten him up, Hadome's eyes swelling so quickly that just before school was dismissed, it looked grotesque, like a big purple eggplant. Obinze had stood outside the toilet with other boys, boys who did not join in the beating, but who laughed along, boys who taunted and goaded, boys who shouted, "Homo! Homo!"
"This is our friend Alexa. Alexa's just moved into a new place in Holland Park after years in France, and so lucky us, we'll be seeing much more of her. She works in music publishing. She's also a fantastic poet," Emenike said.
"Oh, stop it," Alexa said, and then turning to Obinze, she asked, "So where are you from, darling?"
"Nigeria. No, no, I mean in London, darling.
I live in Essex, actually," he said.
"I see," she said, as though disappointed.
She was a small woman with a very pale face and tomato red hair.
Shall we eat, boys and girls? She picked up one of the plates and examined it.
I love these plates. Georgina and Amenike are never boring, are they?
Hannah said.
We bought them from this bazaar in India,
Amenike said.
Handmade by rural women. Just so beautiful. See the detail at the edges?
He raised one of the plates.
Sublime,
Hannah said, and looked at Obinze.
Yes, very nice,
Obinze mumbled. Those plates with their amateur finishing, the slight lumpiness of their edges, would never be shown in the presence of guests in Nigeria. He was still not sure whether Amenike had become a person who believed that something was beautiful because it was handmade by poor people in a foreign country, or whether he had simply learned to pretend so. Georgina poured the drinks. Amenike served the starter, crab with hard-boiled eggs. He had taken on a careful and calibrated charm. He said, "Oh dear," often. When Philip complained about the French couple building a house next to his in Cornwall, Amenike asked,
"Are they between you and the sunset?"
Are they between you and the sunset? It would never occur to Obinze or to anybody he had grown up with to ask a question like that.
So, how was America?
Philip asked.
A fascinating place, really. We spent a few days with Hugo in Jackson, Wyoming. You met Hugo last Christmas, didn't you, Mark?
Yes. So what's he doing there? Mark seemed unimpressed by the plates. He had not, like his wife, picked one up to look at it.
It's a ski resort, but it's not pretentious. In Jackson, they say people who go to Aspen expect somebody to tie their ski boots up for them.
Georgina said,
"The thought of skiing in America makes me quite ill,"
Alexa said.
"Why?"
Hannah asked.
"Have they got a Disney station in the resort, with Mickey Mouse in ski gear?"
Alexa asked.
Alexa's only been to America once, when she was in school, but she loves to hate it from afar, Georgina said.
"I've loved America from afar my whole life,"
Obinze said. Alexa turned to him in slight surprise, as though she had not expected him to speak. Under the chandelier light, her red hair took on a strange, unnatural glow.
"What I've noticed being here is that many English people are in awe of America, but also deeply resent it,"
Obinze said.
"Perfectly true,"
Philip said, nodding at Obinze.
"Perfectly true. It's the resentment of a parent whose child has become far more beautiful and with a far more interesting life."
"But the Americans love us Brits. They love the accent and the Queen and the double-decker,"
Amenike said. There, it had been said, the man considered himself British.
"And the great revelation Amenike had while we were there,"
Georgina said, smiling, "the difference between the American and British, bye."
"Bye?" Alexa asked.
"Yes. He says the Brits draw it out much more, while Americans make it short." "That was a great revelation. It explained everything about the differences between both countries,"
Amenike said, knowing that they would laugh, and they did.
"I was also thinking about the difference in approaching foreigners. Americans will smile at you and be extremely friendly, but if your name is not Corey or Chad, they make no effort at saying it properly. The Brits will be surly and will be suspicious if you're too friendly, but they will treat foreign names as though they are actually valid names."
"That's interesting,"
Hannah said. Georgina said,
"It's a bit tiresome to talk about America being insular. Not that we help that much, since if something major happens in America, it is the headline in Britain. Something major happens here, it's on the back page in America, if at all. But I do think the most troubling thing was the garishness of the nationalism. Don't you think so, darling?"
Georgina turned to Amenike.
"Absolutely," Amenike said. "Oh, and we went to a rodeo. Hugo thought we might fancy a bit of culture."
There was a general tittering laughter. "And we saw this quite unbelievable parade of little children with heavily made-up faces. And then there was a lot of flag-waving and a lot of God bless America. I was terrified that it was the sort of place where you did not know what might happen if you suddenly said, 'I don't like America.' I found America quite jingoistic, too, when I did my fellowship training there," Mark said. Mark is a paediatric surgeon, Georgina said to Obinze. One got the sense that people, progressive people, that is, because American conservatives come from an entirely different planet even to this Tory, felt that they could very well criticise their country, but they didn't like it at all when you did, Mark said.
Where were you?
Emenike asked, as if he knew America's smallest corners. Philadelphia, a specialty hospital called the Children's Hospital. It was quite a remarkable place, and the training was very good. It might have taken me 2 years in England to see the rare cases that I had in a month there. But you didn't stay, Alexa said, almost triumphantly. I hadn't planned on staying. Mark's face never quite dissolved into any expression. Speaking of which, I've just got involved with this fantastic charity that's trying to stop the UK from hiring so many African health workers, Alexa said. There are simply no doctors and nurses left on that continent. It's an absolute tragedy. African doctors should stay in Africa. Why shouldn't they want to practice where there is regular electricity and regular pay? Mark asked, his tone flat. Obinze sensed that he did not like Alexa at all. I'm from Grimsby, and I certainly don't want to work in a district hospital there. But it isn't quite the same thing, is it? We're speaking of some of the world's poorest people. The doctors have a responsibility as Africans. Alexa said, life isn't fair, really. If you have the privilege of that medical degree, then it comes with a responsibility to help their people. I see. I don't suppose any of us should have that responsibility for the blighted towns in the north of England, Mark said. Alexa's face reddened. In the sudden tense silence, the air wrinkling between them all, Georgina got up and said, everyone ready for my roast lamb? They all praised the meat, which Obinze wished had stayed a little longer in the oven. He carefully cut around his slice, eating the sides that had greyed from cooking, and leaving on his plate the bits stained with pinkish blood. Hannah led the conversation, as though to smooth the air, her voice calming, bringing up subjects they would all agree on, changing to something else if she sensed a looming disagreement. Their conversation was symphonic, voices flowing into one another, in agreement. How atrocious to treat those Chinese cockle-pickers like that. How absurd, the idea of fees for higher education. How preposterous that fox-hunting supporters had stormed Parliament. They laughed when Obinze said, I don't understand why fox-hunting is such a big issue in this country. Aren't there more important things? What could possibly be more important? Mark asked dryly. Well, it's the only way we know how to fight our class warfare, Alexa said. The landed gentry and the aristocrats hunt, you see, and we liberal middle classes fume about it. We want to take their silly little toys away. We certainly do, Philip said. It's monstrous. Did you read about Blunkett saying he doesn't know how many immigrants there are in the country? Alexa asked, and Obinze immediately tensed, his chest tightening. Immigrant, of course, is code for Muslim, Mark said. If he really wanted to know, he would go to all the construction sites in this country and do a head count, Philip said. It was quite interesting to see how this plays out in America, Georgina said. They're kicking up a fuss about immigration as well, although, of course, America has always been kinder to immigrants than Europe. Well, yes, but that is because countries in Europe were based on exclusion, not as in America on inclusion, Mark said.
But it's also a different psychology, isn't it?
Hannah said.
European countries are surrounded by countries that are similar to one another, while America has Mexico, which is really a developing country, and so it creates a different psychology about immigration and borders.
But we don't have immigrants from Denmark. We have immigrants from Eastern Europe, which is our Mexico, Alexa said.
Except, of course, for race, Georgina said. Eastern Europeans are white, Mexicans are not.
How do you see race in America, by the way, Emenike?
Alexa asked. It's an iniquitously racist country, isn't it?
He doesn't have to go to America for that, Alexa, Georgina said.
It seemed to me that in America, blacks and whites work together but don't play together, and here blacks and whites play together but don't work together,
Emenike said. The others nodded thoughtfully, as though he had said something profound, but Mark said, I'm not sure I quite understand that.
I think class in this country is in the air that people breathe. Everyone knows their place. Even the people who are angry about class have somehow accepted their place, Obinze said. A white boy and a black girl who grow up in the same working-class town in this country can get together and race will be secondary. But in America, even if the white boy and black girl grow up in the same neighborhood, race would be primary. Alexa gave him another surprised look.
A bit simplified, but yes, that's sort of what I meant,
Emenike said slowly, leaning back on his chair, and Obinze sensed a rebuke. He should have been quiet. This, after all, was Emenike's stage.
But you haven't really had to deal with any racism here, have you, Emenike?
Alexa asked, and her tone implied that she already knew the answer to the question was no.
Of course, people are prejudiced, but aren't we all prejudiced?
Well, no, Georgina said firmly. You should tell the story of the cabbie, darling.
Oh, that story,
Emenike said, as he got up to serve the cheese plate, murmuring something in Hannah's ear that made her smile and touch his arm. How thrilled he was to live in Georgina's world.
Do tell,
Hannah said. And so Emenike did. He told the story of the taxi that he had hailed one night on Upper Street. From afar, the cab light was on, but as the cab approached him, the light went off, and he assumed the driver was not on duty. After the cab passed him by, he looked back idly and saw that the cab light was back on, and that a little way up the street it stopped for two white women. Emenike had told Obinze this story before, and he was struck now by how differently Emenike told it. He did not mention the rage he had felt standing on that street and looking at the cab. He was shaking, he had told Obinze, his hands trembling for a long time, a little frightened by his own feelings. But now, sipping the last of his red wine, flowers floating in front of him, he spoke in a tone cleansed of anger, thick only with a kind of superior amusement, while Georgina interjected to clarify, "Can you believe that?" Alexa, flushed with red wine, her eyes red below her scarlet hair, changed the subject.
"Blunkett must be sensible and make sure this country remains a refuge. People who have survived frightful wars must absolutely be allowed in."
She turned to Obinze.
"Don't you agree?"
"Yes," he said, and felt alienation run through him like a shiver. Alexa and the other guests, and perhaps even Georgina, all understood the fleeing from war, from the kind of poverty that crushed human souls, but they would not understand the need to escape from the oppressive lethargy of choicelessness. They would not understand why people like him, who were raised well-fed and watered, but mired in dissatisfaction, conditioned from birth to look towards somewhere else, eternally convinced that real lives happened in that somewhere else, were now resolved to do dangerous things, illegal things, so as to leave. None of them starving, or raped, or from burned villages, but merely hungry for choice and certainty. Chapter 30 Nicholas gave Obinze a suit for the wedding.
"It's a good Italian suit," he said. "It's small for me, so it should fit you."
The trousers were big and bunched up when Obinze tightened his belt, but the jacket, also big, shielded this unsightly pleat of cloth at his waist. Not that he minded. So focused was he on getting through the day, on finally beginning his life, that he would have swaddled his lower parts in a baby's nappy if that were required. He and Iloba met Cleotilde near the civic center. She was standing under a tree with her friends, her hair pushed back in a white band, her eyes boldly lined in black. She looked like an older, sexier person. Her ivory dress was tight at her hips. He had paid for the dress.
"I haven't got any proper going-out dress," she had said in apology when she called to tell him that she had nothing that looked convincingly bridal.
She hugged him. She looked nervous, and he tried to deflect his own nervousness by thinking about them together after this, how in less than an hour he would be free to walk with surer steps on Britain's streets, and free to kiss her.
"You'll have the rings?"
Iloba asked her.
"Yes,"
Cleotilde said. She and Obinze had bought them the week before, plain, matching cheap rings from a side street shop, and she had looked so delighted, laughingly slipping different rings on and then off her finger, that he wondered if she wished it were a real wedding.
15 minutes to go, Iloba said.
He had appointed himself the organizer. He took pictures, his digital camera held away from his face, saying,
Move closer. Okay, one more.
His sprightly good spirits annoyed Obinze. On the train up to Newcastle the previous day, while Obinze had spent his time looking out of the window, unable even to read, Iloba had talked and talked, until his voice became a distant murmur, perhaps because he was trying to keep Obinze from worrying too much. Now he talked to Cleotilde's friends with an easy friendliness, about the new Chelsea coach, about Big Brother, as if they were all there for something ordinary and normal.
Time to go, Iloba said.
They walked towards the civic centre. The afternoon was bright with sunshine. Obinze opened the door and stood aside for the others to go ahead into the sterile hallway, where they paused to get their bearings, to be sure which way to go towards the register office. Two policemen stood behind the door, watching them with stony eyes. Obinze quieted his panic. There was nothing to worry about, nothing at all, he told himself. The civic centre probably had policemen present as a matter of routine. But he sensed in the sudden smallness of the hallway, the sudden thickening of doom in the air, that something was wrong. Before he noticed another man approaching him, his shirt sleeves rolled up, his cheeks so red he looked as though he was wearing terrible makeup.
Are you Obinze Madueze?
The red-cheeked man asked. In his hands was a sheaf of paper, and Obinze could see a photocopy of his passport page.
Yes, Obinze said quietly, and that word, yes, was an acknowledgement to the red-cheeked immigration officer, to Iloba, and to Cleotilde, and to himself, that it was over.
Your visa expired, and you are not allowed to be present in the UK, the red-cheeked man said. A policeman clamped handcuffs around his wrists. He felt himself watching the scene from far away, watching himself walk to the police car outside, and sink into the too soft seat in the back. There had been so many times in the past when he had feared that this would happen, so many moments that had become one single blur of panic, and now it felt like the dull echo of an aftermath. Cleotilde had flung herself on the ground and begun to cry. She might never have visited her father's country, but he was convinced at that moment of her Africanness. How else would she be able to fling herself to the ground with that perfect, dramatic flourish? He wondered if her tears were for him, or for herself, or for what might have been between them. She had no need to worry, though, since she was a European citizen. The policeman barely glanced at her. It was he who felt the heaviness of the handcuffs during the drive to the police station, who silently handed over his watch and his belt and his wallet, who watched the policeman take his phone and switch it off. Nicholas's large trousers were slipping down his hips.
Your shoes, too. Take off your shoes, the policeman said.
He took off his shoes. He was led to a cell. It was small, with brown walls, and the metal bars so thick his hand could not go around one, reminded him of the chimpanzee's cage at Nsoka's dismal, forgotten zoo. From the very high ceilings, a single bulb burned. There was an emptying, echoing vastness in that tiny cell.
Were you aware that your visa had expired?
Yes, Obinze said.
Were you about to have a sham marriage?
No, Cleotilde and I have been dating for a while.
I can arrange for a lawyer for you, but it's obvious you'll be deported, the immigration officer said evenly.
When the lawyer came, puffy-faced, dark and arcs under his eyes, Obinze remembered all the films in which the state lawyer is distracted and exhausted. He came with a bag, but did not open it, and he sat across from Obinze, holding nothing, no file, no paper, no pen. His demeanour was pleasant and sympathetic.
The government has a strong case, and we can appeal, but to be honest, it will only delay the case, and you will eventually be removed from the UK,
he said, with the air of a man who had said those same words, in that same tone, more times than he wished to, or could remember.
I am willing to go back to Nigeria, Obinze said.
The last shard of his dignity was like a wrapper slipping off that he was desperate to retie. The lawyer looked surprised.
Okay, then, he said,
and got up a little too hastily, as though grateful that his job had been made easier. Obinze watched him leave. He was going to tick on a form that his client was willing to be removed. Removed. That word made Obinze feel inanimate, a thing to be removed, a thing without breath and mind, a thing. He hated the cold heaviness of the handcuffs, the mark he imagined they left on his wrists, the glint of the interlinking circles of metal that robbed him of movement. There he was, in handcuffs, being led through the hall of Manchester Airport, and in the coolness and din of that airport, men and women and children, travellers and cleaners and security guards, watched him, wondering what evil he had done. He kept his gaze on a tall white woman hurrying ahead, hair flying behind her, knapsack hunched on her back. She would not understand his story, why he was now walking through the airport with metal clamped around his wrists, because people like her did not approach travel with anxiety about visas. She might worry about money, about a place to stay, about safety, perhaps even about visas, but never with an anxiety that wrenched at her spine. He was led into a room, bunk beds pushed forlornly against the walls. Three men were already there. One from Djibouti, said little, lying and staring at the ceiling as though retracing the journey of how he had ended up at a holding facility in Manchester Airport. Two were Nigerian. The younger sat up on his bed, eternally cracking his fingers. The older paced the small room and would not stop talking.
"Bros, how did they get you?"
he asked Obinze, with an instant familiarity that Obinze resented. Something about him reminded Obinze of Vincent. Obinze shrugged and said nothing to him. There was no need for courtesies simply because they shared a cell. "Is there anything I could have to read, please?" Obinze asked an immigration officer when she came to lead the man from Djibouti out to see a visitor. "Read?" she repeated, eyebrows raised.
"Yes, a book or a magazine or a newspaper,"
Obinze said. "You want to read?" she said, and on her face a contemptuous amusement. "Sorry, but we've got a TV room and you're allowed to go there and watch telly after lunchtime." In the TV room, there was a group of men, many of them Nigerians, talking loudly. The other men sat around, slumped into their own sorrows, listening to the Nigerians trade their stories, sometimes laughing, sometimes self-pitying.
This now my second time. The first time I come with different passport,"
one of them said.
"Now for work where they get me."
"I get one guy where they deport. Him don't come back getting paper. Now him will go help me,"
another said. Obinze envied them for what they were, men who casually changed names and passports, who would plan and come back and do it over again because they had nothing to lose. He didn't have their savoir-faire. He was soft, a boy who had grown up eating cornflakes and reading books, raised by a mother during a time when truth-telling was not yet a luxury. He was ashamed to be with them, among them. They did not have his shame, and even this, too, he envied. In detention, he felt raw, skinned, the outer layers of himself stripped off. His mother's voice on the phone was almost unfamiliar, a woman speaking a crisp Nigerian English, telling him calmly to be strong, that she would be in Lagos to receive him. And he remembered how years ago, when General Buhari's government stopped giving essential commodities and she no longer came home with free tins of milk, she had begun to grind soya beans at home to make milk. She said soya milk was more nutritious than cow milk, and although he refused to drink the grainy fluid in the morning, he watched her do so with an uncomplaining common sense. It was what she showed now over the phone, telling him she would come and pick him up, as though she had always nursed the possibility of this, her son in detention, waiting to be removed from a country overseas. He thought a lot about Ifemelu, imagining what she was doing, how her life had changed. She had once told him in university, "You know what I admired most about you in secondary school? That you never had a problem saying, 'I don't know.' Other boys pretended to know what they didn't know, but you just had this confidence, and you could always admit that you didn't know something." He had thought it an unusual compliment, and had cherished this image of himself, perhaps because he knew it was not entirely true. He wondered what she would think if she knew where he was now. She would be sympathetic, he was sure, but would she also, in a small way, be disappointed? He almost asked Iloba to contact her. It would not be difficult to find her. He already knew she lived in Baltimore, but he did not ask Iloba. When Iloba visited him, he talked about lawyers. They both knew that there was no point, but still Iloba talked about lawyers. He would sit across from Ubinze, rest his head on his hand, and talk about lawyers. Ubinze wondered if some of the lawyers existed only in Iloba's mind.
I know one lawyer in London, a Ghanaian. He represented this man with no papers. The man was almost on a plane home, and the next thing we knew, the man was free. He now works in IT.
Other times, Iloba took comfort in stating what was obvious.
If only the marriage was just done before they came, he said. You know, if they had come even 1 second after you were pronounced man and wife, they would not touch you.
Ubinze nodded. He knew, and Iloba knew that he knew. On Iloba's last visit, after Ubinze told him that he was being moved to Dover the next day, Iloba began to cry.
Zed, this was not supposed to happen like this.
Iloba, why are you talking rubbish?
Stop crying, my friend,
Ubinze said, pleased to be in a position to pretend strength. And yet when Nicholas and Odjugo visited, he disliked how strenuously they tried to be positive, to pretend almost as though he was merely ill in hospital and they had come to visit him. They sat across from him, the bare cold table between them, and talked about the mundane, Odjugo speaking a little too quickly, and Nicholas saying more in an hour than Ubinze had heard him say in weeks. Ney had been accepted into the National Children's Orchestra, and now had won yet another prize. They brought him money, novels, a bag of clothes. Nicholas had shopped for him, and most of the clothes were new and in his size. Odjugo often asked,
"But are they treating you well? Are they treating you well?"
as though the treatment was what mattered, rather than the blighted reality of it all, that he was in a holding centre about to be deported. Nobody behaved normally. They were all under the spell of his misfortune.
"They are waiting for seats on a flight to Lagos," Ubinze said. "They'll keep me in Dover until there's a seat available."
Ubinze had read about Dover in a newspaper, a former prison. It felt surreal to be driven past the electronic gates, the high walls, the wires. His cell was smaller, colder, than the cell in Manchester, and his cellmate, another Nigerian, told him that he was not going to allow himself to be deported. He had a hardened, fleshless face.
"I will take off my shirt and my shoes when they try to board me. I will seek asylum," he told Ubinze. "If you take off your shirt and your shoes, they will not board you."
He repeated this often, like a mantra. From time to time he farted loudly, wordlessly, and from time to time he sank to his knees in the middle of their tiny cell, hands raised up to the heavens, and prayed,
"Father, Lord, I praise your name. Nothing is too much for you. I bless your name."
His palms were deeply etched with lines. Ubinze wondered what atrocities those hands had seen. He felt suffocated in that cell, let out only to exercise and to eat, food that brought to mind a bowl of boiled worms. He could not eat. He felt his body slackening, his flesh disappearing. By the day he was led into a van one early morning, a fuzz of hair like carpet grass had covered his entire jaw. It was not yet dawn. He was with 2 women and 5 men, all handcuffed, all bound for Nigeria, and they were marched at Heathrow Airport, through security and immigration, and onto the plane, while other passengers stared. They were seated at the very back in the last row of seats, closest to the toilet. Ubinze sat unmoving throughout the flight. He did not want his tray of food. "No, thank you," he said to the flight attendant. The woman next to him said eagerly,
"Can I have his own?"
She had been at Dover, too. She had very dark lips and a buoyant, undefeated manner. She would, he was sure, get another passport, with another name, and try again. As the plane began its descent into Lagos, a flight attendant stood above them and said loudly,
"You cannot leave. An immigration officer will come to take charge of you."
Her face, tight with disgust, as though they were all criminals bringing shame on upright Nigerians like her. The plane emptied out. Ubinze looked through the window at an old jet standing in the mild late afternoon sun, until a uniformed man came walking down the aisle. His belly was large. It must have been a struggle to button up his shirt.
Yes, yes, I have come to take charge of you. Welcome home,
he said humorously, and he reminded Obinze of that Nigerian ability to laugh, to so easily reach for amusement. He had missed that.
We laugh too much, his mother once said. Maybe we should laugh less and solve our problems more.
The uniformed man led them to an office and handed out forms, name, age, country you have come from.
Did they treat you well?
The man asked Obinze.
Yes, Obinze said.
So, do you have anything for the boys?
Obinze looked at him for a moment, his open face, his simple view of the world. Deportations happened every day, and the living went on living. Obinze brought from his pocket a 10-pound note, part of the money Nicholas had given him. The man took it with a smile. Outside, it was like breathing steam. He felt light-headed. A new sadness blanketed him. The sadness of his coming days, when he would feel the world slightly off-kilter, his vision unfocused. At the cordoned-off area near arrivals, standing apart from the other expectant people, his mother was waiting for him. Part 4 Chapter 31 After Ifemelu broke up with Kurt, she told Ginnika,
There was a feeling I wanted to feel that I did not feel.
What are you talking about? You cheated on him.
Ginnika shook her head as though Ifemelu were mad.
Ifem, honestly, sometimes I don't understand you.
It was true. She had cheated on Kurt with a younger man who lived in her apartment building in Charles Village and played in a band. But it was also true that she had longed with Kurt to hold emotions in her hand that she never could. She had not entirely believed herself while with him, happy, handsome Kurt, with his ability to twist life into the shapes he wanted. She loved him, and the spirited, easy life he gave her, and yet she often fought the urge to create rough edges, to squash his sunniness, even if just a little.
I think you are a self-sabotager, Ginnika said. That's why you cut off Obinze like that, and now you cheat on Kurt because at some level you don't think you deserve happiness.
Now you are going to suggest some pills for self-sabotage disorder, Ifemelu said. That's absurd.
So why did you do it?
It was a mistake. People make mistakes. People do stupid things.
She had done it, in truth, because she was curious. But she would not tell Ginnika this, because it would seem flippant. Ginnika would not understand. Ginnika would prefer a grave and important reason, like self-sabotage. She was not even sure she liked him. Rob, who wore dirty ripped jeans, grimy boots, rumpled flannel shirts. She did not understand grunge, the idea of looking shabby because you could afford not to be shabby. It mocked true shabbiness. The way he dressed made him seem superficial to her. And yet, she was curious about him, about how he would be naked in bed with her. The sex was good the first time. She was on top of him, gliding and moaning and grasping the hair on his chest, and feeling faintly and glamorously theatrical as she did so. But the second time, after she arrived at his apartment and he pulled her into his arms, a great torpor descended on her. He was already breathing heavily, and she was extracting herself from his embrace and picking up her handbag to leave. In the elevator, she was overcome with the frightening sense that she was looking for something solid, flailing, and all she touched dissolved into nothingness. She went to Kurt's apartment and told him.
It meant nothing. It happened once. And I am so sorry.
Stop playing, he said.
But she knew from the unbelieving horror that was deepening the blue of his eyes that he knew she was not playing. It took hours of sidestepping each other, of drinking tea and putting on music and checking email, of Kurt lying face up on the couch, still and silent, before he asked,
Who is he?
She told him the man's name, Rob.
He's white?
She was surprised that he would ask her this, and so soon.
Yes.
She had first seen Rob months before, in the elevator, with his unkempt clothes and unwashed hair, and he had smiled at her and said, I see you around. After that, whenever she saw him, He looked at her with a kind of lazy interest, as though they both knew that something would happen between them, and it was only a matter of when.
Who the fuck is he?
Kurt asked. She told him that he lived on the floor above hers, that they said hello to each other, and nothing else until that evening when she saw him coming back from the liquor store, and he asked if she'd like to have a drink with him, and she did a stupid, impulsive thing.
You gave him what he wanted,
Kurt said. The planes of his face were hardening. It was an odd thing for Kurt to say, the sort of thing Auntie Uju, who thought of sex as something a woman gave a man at a loss to herself, would say. In a sudden giddy fit of recklessness, she corrected Kurt.
I took what I wanted. If I gave him anything, then it was incidental. Listen to yourself. Just fucking listen to yourself.
Kurt's voice had hoarsened.
How could you do this to me? I was so good to you.
He was already looking at their relationship through the lens of the past tense. It puzzled her, the ability of romantic love to mutate. How quickly a loved one could become a stranger. Where did the love go? Perhaps real love was familial, somehow linked to blood, since love for children did not die as romantic love did. You won't forgive me, she said, a half question.
Bitch,
he said. He wielded the word like a knife. It came out of his mouth sharp with loathing. To hear Kurt say bitch so coldly felt surreal, and tears gathered in her eyes, knowing that she had turned him into a man who could say bitch so coldly, and wishing he was a man who would not have said bitch, no matter what. Alone in her apartment, she cried and cried, crumpled on her living room rug that was so rarely used it still smelled of the store. Her relationship with Kurt was what she wanted, a crested wave in her life, and yet she had taken an axe and hacked at it. Why had she destroyed it? She imagined her mother saying it was the devil. She wished she believed in the devil, in a being outside of yourself that invaded your mind and caused you to destroy that which you cared about. She spent weeks calling Kurt, waiting in front of his building, until he came out, saying over and over how sorry she was, how much she wanted to work through things. On the day she woke up and finally accepted that Kurt would not return her calls, would not open the door of his apartment, no matter how hard she knocked, she went alone to their favorite bar downtown. The bartender, the one who knew them, gave her a gentle smile, a sympathy smile. She smiled back and ordered another mojito, thinking that perhaps the bartender was better suited for Kurt, with her brown hair blow-dried to satin, her thin arms and tight black clothes, and her ability always to be seamlessly, harmlessly chatty. She would also be seamlessly, harmlessly faithful. If she had a man like Kurt, she would not be interested in a curiosity copulation with a stranger who played unharmonious music. If Emelu stared into her glass, there was something wrong with her. She did not know what it was, but there was something wrong with her. A hunger, a restlessness, an incomplete knowledge of herself. The sense of something farther away, beyond her reach. She got up and left a big tip on the counter. For a long time afterwards, her memory of the end with Kurt was this, speeding down Charles Street in a taxi, a little drunk and a little relieved and a little lonely, with a Punjabi driver who was proudly telling her that his children did better than American children at school. Some years later, at a dinner party in Manhattan, a day after Barack Obama became the Democratic Party's candidate for President of the United States, surrounded by guests, all fervent Obama supporters who were dewy-eyed with wine and victory, a balding white man said,
"Obama will end racism in this country."
And a large-hipped, stylish poet from Haiti agreed, nodding, her afro bigger than Ifemelu's, and said she had dated a white man for 3 years in California, and race was never an issue for them.
"That's a lie," Ifemelu said to her.
"What?"
the woman asked, as though she could not have heard properly.
"It's a lie," Ifemelu repeated. The woman's eyes bulged.
"You're telling me what my own experience was?"
Even though Ifemelu by then understood that people like the woman said what they said to keep others comfortable and to show they appreciated how far we have come. Even though she was by then happily ensconced in a circle of Blaine's friends,
one of whom was the woman's new boyfriend, and even though she should have left it alone, she did not. She could not. The words had once again overtaken her. They overpowered her throat and tumbled out.
The only reason you say that race was not an issue is because you wish it was not. We all wish it was not, but it's a lie. I came from a country where race was not an issue. I did not think of myself as black, and I only became black when I came to America. When you are black in America and you fall in love with a white person, race doesn't matter when you are alone together because it's just you and your love. But the minute you step outside, race matters. But we don't talk about it. We don't even tell our white partners the small things that piss us off and the things we wish they understood better, because we're worried they'll say we're overreacting or we're being too sensitive. And we don't want them to say, look how far we've come. Just 40 years ago, it would have been illegal for us to even be a couple, blah, blah, blah. Because you know what we're thinking when they say that? We're thinking, why the fuck should it ever have been illegal anyway? But we don't say any of this stuff. We let it pile up inside our heads. And when we come to nice liberal dinners like this, we say that race doesn't matter. Because that's what we're supposed to say, to keep our nice liberal friends comfortable. It's true. I speak from experience.
The host, a French woman, glanced at her American husband, a slyly pleased smile on her face. The most unforgettable dinner parties happened when guests said unexpected and potentially offensive things. The poet shook her head and said to the host, I'd love to take some of that wonderful dip home, if you have any left. And looked at the others as though she could not believe they were actually listening to Ifemelu. But they were. All of them hushed, their eyes on Ifemelu, as though she was about to give up a salacious secret that would both titillate and implicate them. Ifemelu had been drinking too much white wine. From time to time she had a swimming sensation in her head, and she would later send apology emails to the host and the poet. But everyone was watching her, even Blaine, whose expression she could not for once read clearly. And so she began to talk about Kurt. It was not that they avoided race, she and Kurt. They talked about it in the slippery way that admitted nothing and engaged nothing and ended with the word crazy, like a curious nugget to be examined and then put aside, or as jokes that left her with a small and numb discomfort that she never admitted to him. And it was not that Kurt pretended that being black and being white were the same in America. He knew they were not. It was instead that she did not understand how he grasped one thing but was completely tone-deaf about another similar thing, how he could easily make one imaginative leap, but be crippled in the face of another. Before his cousin Ashley's wedding, for example, he dropped her off at a small spa near his childhood home to get her eyebrows shaped. Ifemelu walked in and smiled at the Asian woman behind the counter. Hi, I'd like to get my eyebrows waxed.
We don't do curly, the woman said.
You don't do curly?
No, sorry.
Ifemelu gave the woman a long look. It was not worth an argument. If they did not do curly, then they did not do curly, whatever curly was. She called Kurt and asked him to turn around and come back for her, because the salon did not do curly. Kurt walked in, his blue eyes bluer, and said he wanted to talk to the manager right away.
You are going to fucking do my girlfriend's eyebrows, or I'll shut down this fucking place. You don't deserve to have a license.
The woman transformed into a smiling solicitor's coquette.
I'm so sorry, it was a misunderstanding, she said. Yes, they could do the eyebrows.
Ifemelu did not want to, worried that the woman might scold her, rip her skin off, pinch her. But Kurt was too outraged on her behalf, his anger smouldering in the closed air of the spa, and so she sat, tensely, as the woman waxed her eyebrows. As they drove back, Kurt asked,
How is the hair of your eyebrows curly anyway, and how is that hard to fucking wax?
Maybe they've never done a black woman's eyebrows, and so they think it's different, because our hair is different after all, but I guess now she knows that the eyebrows are not that different.
Kurt scoffed, reaching across to take her hand, his palm warm. At the cocktail reception, he kept his fingers meshed with hers. Young females in tiny dresses, their breasts and bellies sucked in, trooped across to say hello to him and to flirt,
asking if he remembered them, Ashley's friend from high school, Ashley's roommate in college. When Kurt said, "This is my girlfriend, Ifemelu," they looked at her with surprise, a surprise that some of them shielded and some of them did not. And in their expressions was the question, "Why her?" It amused Ifemelu. She had seen that look before, on the faces of white women, strangers on the street, who would see her hand clasped in Kurt's and instantly cloud their faces with that look. The look of people confronting a great tribal loss. It was not merely because Kurt was white, it was the kind of white he was, the untamed golden hair and handsome face, the athlete's body, the sunny charm and the smell around him of money. If he were fat, older, poor, plain, eccentric or dreadlocked, then it would be less remarkable, and the guardians of the tribe would be mollified. And it did not help that although she might be a pretty black girl, she was not the kind of black that they could with an effort imagine him with. She was not light-skinned. She was not biracial. At that party, as Kurt held on to her hand, kissed her often, introduced her to everyone, her amusement curdled into exhaustion. The looks had begun to pierce her skin. She was tired even of Kurt's protection, tired of needing protection. Kurt leaned in and whispered, "That one, the one with the bad spray tan, she can't even see her fucking boyfriend's been checking you out since we walked in here." So he had noticed and understood the why her looks. It surprised her. Sometimes in the middle of floating on his bubbly exuberance, he would have a flash of intuition, of surprising perception, and she would wonder if there were other more primal things she was missing about him. Such as when he told his mother, who had glanced at the Sunday newspaper and mumbled that some people were still looking for reasons to complain, even though America was now colorblind. "Come on, mother. What if 10 people who look like Ifemelu suddenly walked in here to eat? You realize our fellow diners will be less than pleased." "Maybe," his mother said, noncommittal, and shot an eyebrow raise of accusation at Ifemelu, as though to say she knew very well who had turned her son into a pathetic race warrior. Ifemelu smiled, a small, victorious smile. And yet. Once they visited his aunt, Claire, in Vermont, a woman who had an organic farm and walked around barefoot and talked about how connected to the earth it made her feel. "Did Ifemelu have such an experience in Nigeria?" she asked, and looked disappointed when Ifemelu said her mother would slap her if she ever stepped outside without shoes. Claire talked throughout the visit about her Kenyan safari, about Mandela's grace, about her adoration for Harry Belafonte, and Ifemelu worried that she would lapse into Ebonics or Swahili. As they left her rambling house, Ifemelu said, "I bet she's an interesting woman, if she'd just be herself. I don't need her to overassure me that she likes black people." And Kurt said it was not about race, it was just that his aunt was hyper-aware of difference. Any difference. "She would have done the exact same thing if I turned up with a blonde Russian," he said. Of course his aunt would not have done the same thing with a blonde Russian. A blonde Russian was white, and his aunt would not feel the need to prove that she liked people who looked like the blonde Russian. But Ifemelu did not tell Kurt this, because she wished it were obvious to him. When they walked into a restaurant with linen-covered tables, and the host looked at them and asked Kurt, "Table for one?" Kurt hastily told her the host did not mean it like that, and she wanted to ask him, how else could the host have meant it? When the strawberry-haired owner of the bed and breakfast in Montreal refused to acknowledge her as they checked in, a steadfast refusal, smiling and looking only at Kurt, she wanted to tell Kurt how slighted she felt, worse because she was unsure whether the woman disliked black people or liked Kurt. But she did not, because he would tell her she was overreacting, or tired, or both. There were simply times that he saw, and times that he was unable to see. She knew that she should tell him these thoughts, that not telling him cast a shadow over them both. Still, she chose silence. Until the day they argued about her magazine. He had picked up a copy of Essence from the pile on her coffee table, on a rare morning that they spent in her apartment, the air still thick with the aroma of the omelette she had made. "This magazine's kind of racially skewed," he said. "What?" "Come on,
Only black women featured?
You're serious, she said. He looked puzzled.
Yeah?
We're going to the bookstore.
What?
I need to show you something.